Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and I welcome you to another episode of Zero Point Teachings. This is a bi-weekly radio show of 2 hours in length, and we explore a wide range of esoteric, mystical, and scientific studies. The aim particularly is to explore the nature of human consciousness and also to approach an understanding of the physics and metaphysics of creation. The basic concept of the nature of a human being espoused in these teachings is radically different from people's common understanding or modern scientific standing. So I'm trying to explain a complex framework of ideas concerning our metaphysical origins. In a way, human consciousness, we have to understand its physics and metaphysics. And that in a sense, we as individuals come down into the material body. Upon death or even during life, we're not dependent upon that body and can experience in other planes of existence. There's overwhelming evidence among all different areas of psychical research that we live in such a multidimensional universe. There's evidence for out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, reincarnation, and numerous other psychical phenomena, none of which can be explained in the basic materialistic paradigm of modern times. Scientists may study the nature of matter and energy within time and space, but somehow there's something hidden at the heart of being which we fail to understand. So I'm trying to elaborate basic mystical esoteric teachings about the nature of the heart and the physics and metaphysics of the heart. The basic idea is that a human being has a zero-point center. And this term, zero point, is actually taken from Madame Blavatsky in The Secret Doctrine, published in 1888. Blavatsky at one point wrote, "Material points without extension, zero points, are the materials out of which the gods and other invisible powers clothe themselves in bodies." Now, the idea here is that at the heart of being, we ourselves have such a zero-point center. And to understand what this means, we have to explore modern physics and ancient metaphysics to understand this idea. But imagine ourselves having such a zero-point center, and that surrounding this center, there are seven spheres or circles. And the dynamics which occur through this zero point then spin a web around a central point, a seven-dimensional web, all spun around a central point. And in that way, this material point without extension is the foundation for these different bodies which form around the central point. Sometimes I play a pointing game when I give lectures, and I have people point to the wall and to the ceiling and to an object in the room, and then to point to your left foot, and finally I ask people to point to themselves. The vast majority of people, when they do the pointing game, indicate self by pointing towards the area of the heart. Although modern science and psychology has assumed for over the past century that it is the brain in the head which produces human consciousness, by which I mean our inner awareness of being, okay, scientists have assumed that the brain produces consciousness, whereas in all of the different mystical traditions, in yoga and the Gita and the Upanishads, in Blavatsky, in Kabbalah and Jewish mysticism, in all the mystical teachings, the deepest level to self is associated with the heart and the awakening of the heart. So your zero point center is, imagine it as at the deepest depth of your own heart. And then everything is spun around that. And it is through some form of ultra metaphysical process that life is generated within the human heart and consciousness comes into the body. But this consciousness in the body is supported by this whole inner physics and metaphysics. The idea in this series also is that we are wanting to strive to awaken consciously. All the mystical traditions portray human beings as being essentially in a sleepwalking state. You're conditioned by everything around you, by your past history, by your worries and concerns, by your desires. Everything serves to condition us into a semi-sleepwalking state. The mystical traditions are concerned with the idea of awakening, which means a quantum shift or alteration in that inner awareness of being. We want to experience higher states of consciousness and refine these within ourselves. So the aim in this series, I'm encouraging the listeners, as you go about your life, to make consistent effort to remember yourself, bringing your attention back to the moment and being present in the fullness of the moment, here, now. So often people, we're living in the past or we're living in the future and have so many things on our minds. What we aim to do, we want to get beyond the level of the egoic consciousness supported within the mind and to awaken the experience, the deeper experience of self connected to the heart, and thereby to learn to live in the heart. The more and more this develops in us, it gives us an altered sense of ourself, of our being. So the striving for unifying or objective knowledge to understand the nature of the creation and the nature of reality, we have to take consciousness into the equation and consider the nature of our own conscious state. If we're in a semi-sleepwalking state, then it's hard for us to imagine or understand what might be revealed in higher states of consciousness. So we have to work on ourselves in a way to develop our instrumentation or our awareness of being. And this is the primary route to knowledge, which has been ignored within the scientific and modern psychology traditions. In those traditions, we think we separate the observer and we observe other people or external phenomena. Where in mystical studies, we have to begin with the study of consciousness within ourselves with the idea that we're striving to awaken. So then as we go about our life, we make efforts to wake up and to be present in the moment, to deepen our breathing. And as we do this, we observe ourselves, the turning of the mind and negative emotions and such. And we try to recognize patterns of our conditioning so that we can free that consciousness from these patterns of conditioning. So the aim through this series is to present different areas of mystical study, dealing with consciousness and the heart and the study of ancient metaphysics and modern physics. I'm trying to present a very complex alternative model of the nature of reality. It's all based upon this idea that a human being indeed has a zero-point center. I also draw from Kabbalah, where it is explained that before creation occurred, that the infinite being had to withdraw from a point in space so that the finite being or finite world might come into existence. And this implies that each human being in the innermost heart space similarly has such a vacated space, a vacated space within the infinite, which then allows us to have our existence as a finite being instead of being swallowed up in the infinite. So the idea then is that a human being has a space within the heart, a vacated space within the heart. And in mystical teachings, in Kabbalah, it is said that God reveals himself in stages within the space of the heart. Okay, so that's some background just as to the general idea of consciousness and the nothingness at the heart of being. Now today, what we're going to be carrying forward our studies of the secret doctrine. Well, I'm getting a fierce storm blowing in here at the moment. I hope there's no interference on the telephone. Today we're going to be focusing again on the secret doctrine, and I have a guest who I'll introduce in a moment who will be taking part in the discussion. Before I begin, I'd like to make a few announcements. Firstly, again, I'd like to thank Don and Doug at BBS Radio for hosting this show and making the shows available through the archives. And I would encourage you, if you hear a show and you're interested in what I'm teaching, you can go back and hear a more progressive development of this material. Okay, secondly, I have a website at www.zeropoint.ca, spelt out zeropoint.ca. And on my website, just under the intro banner, you'll see the link to a page I've set up for today's show. And it has some pictures and quotations from Blavatsky. And I've put some pictures up there which I can refer to through the talk. If you're not able to access the site, well, I'll describe the pictures as I go along anyway. Okay, so if you want to follow along, you can go to Zero Point and follow that link to the page I've set up for the BBS radio show. Secondly, if you want to contact me during the show or afterwards, you can email Christopher Holmes, all small case, at rogers.com. And email address is also on the website. And if there are questions or someone would like to phone in, the phone-in number is 877-876-5227. Okay, so today we'll be discussing the secret doctrine again. And again, I've invited my friend and colleague, James Moffat. James is in Toronto. I'm just south of Ottawa, Ontario. Jim, are you there?
I am.
Yeah, welcome. How's the weather down there?
Sunny and very beautiful, actually.
Oh, yeah, that's nice. We've had a lot of rain on the East Coast over the last couple weeks.
Yeah, we had part of the storms the other day, quite a bit of electrical activity, too. It was very interesting.
Yeah. Well, thanks for being back today, and you're going to just be there in the background.
And I'm just clicking on to your website here and going to your page for the illustrations. Oh, okay, I got it.
Yeah, good.
Good. Yep.
Okay. I guess that's the main announcements. I'll repeat some of the things I've started with last week, just for people who didn't hear what I'd said previously, and I'll try to go on further this week into additional materials. I'm discussing the secret doctrine, the title of Blavatsky's book published in 1888, and I'm focusing on volume one of the book, of the series. It's a two-part series. The first is called Cosmogenesis, on the creation of the universe, or the genesis of the cosmos. And I'm interested in the cosmology and metaphysics presented within the secret doctrine. Now, even book one is a very complex book and has Blavatsky's elaboration on all different religious symbolism and many, many digressions from her main arguments. It's a very complex work. But basically, it is elaborating a model of creation based on the esoteric stanzas of Zan, spelled D-Z-Y-A-N.
I think that might be. I was going to mention that to you. I think it might be Zion, but I could stand corrected on that. But I
Zion.
Think Zion, I think. Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
You mentioned last show that you weren't exactly sure about the pronunciation, but that I've heard that. But
Zion.
I'm not, completely confident that that's true. So for what it's worth.
Good. Now I'll try to remember that. So habitual in my habitual state here, I'll just slip back. Zion. I have trouble enough with sound sometimes.
Okay.
Good. Thanks, Jim.
Okay.
She presents these stanzas early in the book, and there are seven of them and about 20 pages of material, and then she takes 600 pages to elaborate on the meaning of these ancient stanzas. So I think today what I'm going to do is begin by reading the first part of these stanzas, and I'll give some elaborations on what's suggested by the different stanzas. Now, if you read the secret doctrine of Blavatsky, you're not going to easily arrive at the formulation of the secret doctrine that I'm presenting today. Even in my exposure to theosophical materials, there are very few people who realize Blavatsky's profound teachings about zero-point sources. In a way, these are hidden. Even within the secret doctrine, you have to find these pearls of great value within that book. Anyway, to begin with some of the stanzas of Zion.
Pretend the D's not there and pronounce it Zion.
Zion.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, stanza one.
I hope I'm right about this, by the way.
The eternal parent space, wrapped in her ever-invisible robes, had slumbered once again for seven eternities. This is the first stanza of stanza. This is the first verse of stanza one. Now, firstly, the eternal parent. For Blavatsky, the eternal parent is the eternal parent space. And as I explained last week, in modern physics, this would essentially be a form of hyperspace in terms of modern language. See, Blavatsky says that all these different cosmoses emerge out of the parent space. They expand within without, and eventually they withdraw without within back into the parent space. So the parent space is eternal. It is the eternal parent space. Whereas the universes that are created out of this, which Blavatsky refers to as suns, spelled S-O-N-S, the universes are coming and going. But the eternal parent space is the prime source substance out of which these universes appear, and then ultimately they dissolve back into the parent space. Now here, Blavatsky is saying, the eternal parent, wrapped in her ever-invisible robes, had slumbered once again for seven eternities. Now, when she says, wrapped in her ever-invisible robes, Blavatsky elsewhere explains that the eternal parent space is seven-skinned, that it has seven skins, or the cosmic ocean is seven cubits deep, or there's a dragon of wisdom has seven heads. Now, the idea then, the ever-invisible robes, that this sevenfoldness is inherent in the parent space. So there are seven ever-invisible levels to this parent space. And the eternal parent had slumbered once again for seven eternities. Now, Blavatsky explains that the number seven is the number of the divine mysteries. And all patterns of creation, evolution, and such follow the principle of the law of seven, or their sevenfold. So Blavatsky even explains that there are seven nights of Brahma. Brahma is a god of creation. So during the seven nights of Brahma, all of creation is absorbed in non-being. And then creation manifests within without and emerges out of the parent space for 7 days of Brahma, or seven periods or cycles of creation and evolution. So everything is sevenfold. Seven nights of Brahma, then 7 days of Brahma. Okay, so here in this stanza, Blavatsky's describing the eternal parent space had slumbered it once again for seven eternities. Time was not, for it lay asleep in the infinite bosom of duration. Okay, time as we know it didn't exist in this realm of eternity. Time is created with the emergence of the universe. This is how time is regarded in modern science as well, that time came into being at the moment of the Big Bang and the emergence from the singularity. That's when time, space, the space-time complex came into existence. Verse 3. Universal mind was not, for there were no Ahi or celestial beings to contain it. The seven ways to bliss were not. The great causes of misery were not, for there was no one to produce and get ensnared by them. Mainly here we're finding Blavatsky, the stanzas describing what is not existing, because everything is absorbed in non-being. So the ways to bliss are not, and the causes of misery were not. Number 5, darkness alone filled the boundless all. For father, mother, and son were once more one, and the son had not yet awakened for the new wheel and his pilgrimage thereon. So that the different, the metaphysical principles, the father and the mother have yet to produce the son. And we'll see later that Blavatsky describes the absolute as having a triune nature, as simply that, and then its differentiated aspect as the father and as the mother. So elsewhere, she says, when creation happens, she says, the three fall into four. And the fourth is the son that is produced by the eternal father and mother. Okay, so here the son has yet to be reawakened. And darkness fills the boundless all. Number 6, the seven sublime lords and the seven truths had ceased to be. and the universe, the sun of necessity, was immersed in parashpana, to be outbreathed by that which is and yet is not. Not was. So once again, it's describing the absence of existence or of differentiated being. The seven lords are yet to be born. The seven truths have ceased to be. Number seven, the causes of existence had been done away with. The visible that was and the invisible that is rested in eternal non-being, the one being. Alone, the one form of existence stretched boundless, infinite, causeless, in dreamless sleep, and life pulsated unconscious in universal space throughout that all presence. Okay, that's the end of the first stanza. Mainly it's describing the condition before creation is differentiated out of the prime source substances. Stanza 2 picks up, where were the builders, the luminous suns of man's entire dawn? In the unknown darkness, the producers of form from no form, the root of the world, rested in the bliss of non-being. Where was silence? Where the ears to sense it? No, there was neither silence nor sound, not save ceaseless eternal breath, which knows itself not. Now, when I talk about the eternal parent space, this, for Blavatsky, is the divine mother. It's regarded as the feminine principle and as the roots of matter within the parent space. The counterpart, if we take that as roots of matter, the roots of spirit are seen as within the ceaseless eternal breath. And Blavatsky portrays this as this continual breathing or movement in hyperspace. So it's in modern science, we could talk about, if you go down to 0 point levels, what you find is the quantum vacuum is seething with activity. It's never still. You continually have particles are not being created and annihilated within instances of time. Okay, so there's this continual quantum jittering within space, the underlying space itself. So that is similar in ways to what Blavatsky means by the ceaseless eternal breath. That's like the spirit. In the book of Genesis, we find the spirit of God moves across the face of the waters. Well, that duality for Blavatsky, the spirit of God, is this ceaseless eternal breath, that movement of spirit, and it moves across the face of the waters, or the eternal parent space. The eternal parent space is often symbolized by the image of an ocean or waters. It's similar to how the mystic poet Kabir states, inside this jar are seven oceans and innumerable stars. Now, the meaning of that is the jar is a created universe, and inside that jar are seven oceans. Again, Kabir is agreeing with what Blavatsky is saying, that the ocean is the ether. The eternal parent space itself is the ether, the ultimate ether. And all phenomena, material phenomena, arise out of that etheric substance. So this suggests everything that happens in the physical world, in a way, is supported by processes which are occurring at a metaphysical level. So things that happen in four-dimensional space-time are dependent upon processes which are really going on within the underlying seven-dimensional hyperspace. Okay, so coming back to stanzas, there was no style, there was silence, there was no sound, nothing but the ceaseless eternal breath. The hour had not struck. The ray had not yet flashed into the germ. The ray is similar to other teachings like Kabbalah, where a ray of light penetrates into the void. And that is what initiates creation. Okay, but in the stanzas at this point, the ray had not yet flashed into the germ. The Matma Padma had not yet swollen. The Matri Padma means mother lotus. And the universe is compared to a lotus, a flower, So the stanza, verse 4, sorry. Her heart had not yet opened for the one ray to enter, hence to fall as 3 into 4 into the lap of Maya. The 7 were not yet born from the web of light. Darkness alone was father, mother. These 2 are the germ, and the germ is 1. The universe was still concealed in divine thought and the divine bosom. Okay, so that's half of stanza 2. Now, what Blavatsky is describing here, firstly, she is suggesting, I remind you, she was writing in 1888. And Stephen Hawking, he says in the 1800s, no one had any reason to believe the universe had been created or that it has always been in its present form. But in 1888, Blavatsky wasn't saying that. She was depicting creation out of nothingness, that everything emerged out of what seems to be non-being. So in modern science, they've now arrived at the idea of vacuum genesis, because when they trace the universe back into the first instance of creation, they trace it to a singularity or zero-point source, and that is produced out of the quantum vacuum. It's also an ancient Christian idea, creation ex nihilo, creation out of nothingness. So that's one of the first things depicted within the stanzas of Zion. Okay, creation out of nothingness. And Blavatsky's trying, in the Secret Doctrine, is trying to explain the nature of these primordial substances out of which the universe emerged. So she's talking about incredibly complex and subtle ideas and processes, things beyond finite mind and beyond our ordinary understanding. Her two principal, she talks a lot, or she refers to what she calls the theological triunity. And if you have a piece of paper before you, do a triangle, and at the apex put beingness, like pure being, unspeakable, she puts at the apex. And then on the one side, she puts the eternal ceaseless breath, and on the other side, the eternal parent space. These she calls the theological trinity, and these three then produce the fourth element, which is the sun, and that the sun appears, firstly, originates from a zero-point source, produced out of this underlying realm. Now, modern scientists similarly now trace the universe back through a zero-point into the quantum vacuum. And scientists are concerned with whether or not the universe will continue to expand, or is there enough matter or dark energy that will eventually stop the expansion of the universe and lead to a process of contraction, in which case the universe could collapse in upon itself more and more, and forming black holes which might coalesce And scientists even conceive today of the universe all disappearing again into a black hole. This scenario is called the Big Crunch. The universe begins in a big bang and it might end in a big crunch and again disappear to a zero-point level back into the nothingness. This is what Blavatsky was describing in 1888. Now, this idea is compatible with modern science. Aspects of science doesn't support the concept because scientists think the universe is expanding more rapidly at this time and there's no evidence of contraction. But that would be a future state. Blavatsky sees universes emerging out of the eternal parent space and eventually being absorbed into the eternal parent space. And she sees an infinite number of these occurring over endless time. And this whole scenario, then, of zero-point sources, expansion and contraction of universes out of the prime source substances, all of these ideas are compatible with modern concepts in cosmology. Okay, I'll maybe stop for a moment Jim, any comments or thoughts on...
Well, I just had, you know, when you just made reference to modern science's talk about going back to the singularity at the beginning of creation and going beyond that, and you made reference to the similarities with Madame Blavatsky, but perhaps you could just explain a little bit more about the modern scientific view as to how we arrive, what a singularity is, because I think you kind of went over that, and I don't really think you've defined a zero point that clearly so far, too. So maybe you could just talk a little bit about that idea, about how you can measure everything back in time to a certain point, and then everything breaks down.
Good, okay. This concept of zero points and singularity is so profoundly complex to grasp or define what it is. In modern physics, they used to believe in the Big Bang, and they thought the universe began with something like a massive sun which exploded into space and creating all the matter and energy and matter for the galaxies and so on. In the early part of this century, they traced the universe back further and further into the first instances of creation. Now, see, the general theory of relativity in science describes a space-time curvature. And there's no reason according to the general theory of relativity, the universe emerged from this point source, and there's nothing to prevent that point of infinite concentration. Scientists arrive at what's called the singularity is at a particular length. It's 10 to the minus 35 centimeters. So a singularity point is a billion billionth the diameter of a proton, inconceivably small. So the scientists think that our universe emerged from that point source level. Now, the 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, that distance is set because of the uncertainty principle in quantum physics, which means you can only measure a particle's position or momentum with a certain degree of accuracy. You can never measure it absolutely precisely. And the more you try to know its position and momentum at the same time, if you measure its position, its momentum becomes completely undefined, or it passes to infinity. Or if you measure its momentum, its position becomes completely unknown. You can't know both parameters at the same time. So as scientists trace the universe back into the first instance of creation, you lose sight of it. It passes beyond the level at which we can measure. So that's a basic concept of the singularity. It's like a point source beyond which we can measure. Anything else, Jim, would you suggest?
Well, I guess, as you say, it's difficult to explain because it's very complex, and you have to kind of grasp it as over time. But the implication of that, though, as you were talking earlier about vacuum genesis, is that scientists trace the material world back to the time that almost at the beginning of time, in which everything in the material world was concentrated in this infinitesimally small point, and then there was the Big Bang or whatever, then everything began to expand. But the implication is that in order to explain the creation, you have to go beyond that point, and that leads into what? Something...
Well, the study of metaphysics.
Scientific terms, I'd say that led to the vacuum genesis scenario. There's a sea of energy and intelligence beyond that which we can measure, in which everything emerged from, or which was
which is
the source of everything. Well, I guess that's very interesting in terms of what you're talking about with Madame Blavatsky in 1888 and Stephen Hawking's statement that, you know, there was never really nobody really believed in those days that the universe had to be explained in terms beyond those that were common in Newton's worldview, where there was absolute space and time. And if you look at the whole of the 20th century of physics, which is, you know, this incredible intellectual achievement first with relativity theory and then with quantum theory, and how this view has emerged, this extraordinary view of vacuum genesis and the quantum vacuum and what you spoke of in one of the last programs, 11-dimensional space and all these extremely complex and really almost inexplicable and beyond all logic explanations. It's interesting that Madame Blavatsky was saying all this in 1888 and saying it in extremely detailed sense, you know, with many more other elements that aren't in modern physics.
It's amazing how her material makes so much more sense in light of modern physics, whereas in her day it must have been almost incomprehensible. But what you were saying about, like, you were exactly right, saying, okay, so you trace the singularity back into what? The quantum vacuum and what's beyond that. In modern physics, one physicist said, all of physics is in the vacuum. And the nature of the quantum vacuum is like the number one hot topic in modern physics. The kind of nature of that nothingness. Because scientists realize more and more in modern physics that the space is not empty. Instead, as you get down into the Planckian lengths in space itself, there's this infinite potential and energy and latency and information all latent within space, which is invisible to us. So the study of the structure of the quantum vacuum, that's the focus of modern science. And if you had Blavatsky's view, you would say, well, this quantum vacuum has an inherent sevenfold nature. That's what you would predict. Like, that's a scientific hypothesis based on the secret doctrine. It's this quantum vacuum, the underlying ether of space itself, is seven skins. And it's also interesting here, this idea of the ether. Now, in modern science, scientists dismissed the concept of the ether back in the early 1900s. And there was thought that light didn't need a medium, just like sound waves might travel through matter. But light, they thought, they used to think it there had to be an ether. But then the idea of the ether was dismissed. But in the newer physics, the idea of the ether has come back in, because the ether, the underlying prime source substance, is the quantum vacuum itself. Okay. Okay. So, any further comment, Jim?
Well, just that again, as I say, it's interesting that it used to be thought that in scientific circles that space and time were absolute, and that was the Newtonian worldview. And then Einstein came along with theory of relativity and shattered that notion completely. And then,
It's interesting. Sorry, I'll just stop you here for as we talk about this. What's interesting about Blavatsky's position is that she actually has both the absolute time space of Newton and the relative space time of Einstein. Within her model, she actually has both, because the absolute space for Blavatsky is the eternal parent space, and the absolute time for Blavatsky is this realm that she calls of duration or eternity. So Blavatsky has the absolute space-time, and then out of that emerge created suns, which are relative four-dimensional space-time complexes that emerge out of the absolute, and they ultimately get absorbed back into the absolute. So Blavatsky offers a model of how you can incorporate that element from Newtonian science as well as modern concepts from general relativity. Do you get that, Jim?
I was going to say, without getting too technical, I was going to say that in some ways I think Newton would have been more sympathetic to Blavatsky's ideas about time space than Einstein's in a way. But what I was getting at is that after Einstein came quantum physics, which the impact of those two together reshaped all of physics and our understanding of physics but it didn't do away with Newton's laws or Newton's understanding of the universe. All it did was it relativized it in the sense that we understood that everything Newton said holds true, except when objects approach the speed of light, go very, very fast and approach the speed of light, and that's relativity, or when we go down to very, very small levels of measurement beyond anything that we can see, which is quantum physics. And so in a way, what happened was you could think in these terms, in terms of zero points, is that physics reached in relativity and in quantum physics reached the zero points of Newton's domain, and that had to posit some sort of conceptual scheme which would explain the laws of physics beyond Newton. And so in a way, it's almost as if they're working their way towards metaphysics, even though they wouldn't call it that. I mean, that's how I sort of characterize it in a way. So when Blavatsky says that, physics says in 1888 that the physicists haven't explained the world, that they're going to have to come to metaphysics and mysticism, it's interesting because really the 20th century has in many ways vindicated her predictions.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, the study of modern physics has led us down to these realms, down on Planck zero-point levels and into this prime source substances. Yeah, so as physics has, as Blavatsky predicted, as physics progresses far enough, it'll have to come to metaphysics.
Yeah, and of course,
and
her
explanations... we just don't call it such.
But of course, her explanations are phrased in terms of spiritual terms, and of course physics divorced itself of any spiritual elements many years ago, although Newton of course was one who held spiritual views and thought that God was in space, that was removed later by others. But it's interesting that again, the idea that physics is more objective, is an objective science because there's no spiritual element in it, may turn out to be one of its great, its greatest failing in a sense, that the idea that physics is describing dumb, non-sentient matter may prove to be its greatest weakness also, or that idea I think will eventually be overthrown if it hasn't already.
That's so such a profound difference between Blavatsky's viewpoints and modern science. Like in modern science, the physicists think their ideas are only applicable to the physics of matter, and that their ideas really have nothing to do with the human being or human consciousness. Whereas in Blavatsky's teaching, the same dynamics used to depict the creation of the universe, the macrocosm, the same dynamics are operative within the microcosm, within an individual human being. So the scientist, the physicist, thinks the universe has a zero-point origin, but he doesn't consider that human consciousness might have such a zero-point origin. Whereas Blavatsky, her whole framework of ideas is not just studying the universe out there, but it's also studying the higher dimensional nature to ourselves, that we emerge out of the eternal parent space and through the ceaseless modifications of the ceaseless breath. So that's a profound dissimilarity between mysticism and science. I'm going to proceed on a little bit here. I'll take a quote from Blavatsky describing then one of the fundamental propositions of the secret doctrine is the eternity of the universe as a boundless plane, periodically the playground of numberless universes incessantly manifesting and disappearing, called the manifesting stars and the sparks of eternity. The eternity of the pilgrim is like a wink of the eye of self-existence. The appearance and disappearance of worlds is like a regular tidal ebb of flux and reflux. Okay, so Blavatsky is describing all living beings in a sense as being sparks of eternity. Describing creation, she says, it proceeds from without inward when it is everywhere, and from within outward when it is nowhere. It expands and contracts, exhalation and inhalation. When it expands, the mother diffuses and scatters. When it contracts, the mother draws back and ingathers. This produces the periods of evolution and dissolution, Manvantara and Prayalaya. Hot breath is the father, cool breath is the mother. So here, Blavatsky describes the expansion and contraction of universes, and she relates it to the breath, the modifications of the ceaseless eternal breath, so that movement in hyperspace. She describes the universe, hot breath is the father. So she describes a hot birth to the universe. And the cool breath is the mother, as when things disappear into a black hole. So it's the mother that the father scatters, and it's the mother that ingathers the universe to her bosom at the end of time. So this suggests to me that if scientists are interested in the fate of the universe, one thing they do not conceive is that the contraction of the universe might be produced by a movement within hyperspace, and that it's not simply gravity is not simply due, gravitational collapse would not simply be due to the matter within the universe, but actually would be initiated by movements in hyperspace as the exhalation turns to an inhalation, and then the universe will begin to contract.
Is hyperspace the eternal parent space?
Hyperspace, yes. Yes, it's so, the eternal parent space.
So yeah. in physical terms of modern physics, this is the sea of energy that underlies everything, and in Blavatsky's, it's this eternal space that just is, in
yes.
which there's no differentiation and from which everything emerges.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Okay. Also, Blavatsky says here, she says, the suns expand and contract through their own selves and hearts. They embrace infinitude, each in turn a part of the web. Reflecting the self-existent Lord like a mirror, each becomes in turn a world. So here the important idea is that the expansion and contraction of these suns is associated with the heart. So this is what I'm suggesting, that human beings, we have these deep heart centers, and somehow we emerge out of those into the physical body. And at death, all the energies then gather again to the heart before the soul leaves the body or it persists in other dimensions. Okay. Moving along here, I'd like then to discuss another concept that's very, very important in the secret doctrine, and that is what Blavatsky calls the fundamental dogma of occultism. In the secret doctrine, she states, there is but one indivisible and absolute omniscience and intelligence in the universe, and this thrills throughout every atom and infinitesimal point of the whole finite cosmos. Now, what Blavatsky is saying here is similar to the notion in religion that there is one omnipotent, omnipresent, omniscient being that permeates all of creation. Now, if this is true, it's like Blavatsky saying there's one indivisible omniscience. Omniscience is omni-knowing, intelligence, absolute intelligence, which permeates everything. So this suggests that if you actually took a volume of space around you and the space out in front of you, although that space looks empty, at some level, all the intelligence of the universe is latent at every point, because this omniscience permeates everything. So the whole intelligence of the whole universe permeates every point. Okay, see, Blavatsky is saying the fundamental dogma of occultism is this absolute, ultimate unity of creation, and that everything that appears to be separate and removed from each other is somehow produced as an illusion out of this omnipresent omniscience and field of intelligence. Now, to understand this, there are various ways in which modern science similarly has arrived at the idea of the undivided wholeness or unity of creation. And I'd like to explain two ways of coming to this. The first is within quantum theory itself, and it takes us back to the Einstein-Podborsky-Rosen paradox, or the EPR paradox in quantum physics. Now, in this paradox, Einstein didn't accept quantum theory, and what bothered him about it is what he called the baffling holism suggested by quantum theory. So Einstein and his colleagues posed this paradox to show that quantum theory couldn't possibly be right. Because according to quantum theory, if there are two quanta that share a singlet state, and then those quanta are separated from each other, they're split, and one particle goes off in one direction and the other in another direction, those particles are correlated. Because they emerge from a point source, even though they're separated from each other, they're still correlated. They're phase entangled, it's called in physics. There's a higher dimensional phase space. So although those particles separate, in a way they're still part of one quantum system, and both contains information about the other. So that if the physicist measures one particle, that instantaneously collapses the wave function of the other particle. It's as though you had two twins born from the same mother, and they go off into space, and it's like they feel each other. It's like they're still connected, even though they're removed in external space-time. Now, so any particles or quanta that emerge from a singlet state maintain their phase entanglement. Now, if you think that the whole universe actually emerged from a singlet state, and then that singlet state was divided and divided and divided, but all the way down, everything ultimately contains memory, is interconnected with everything else in terms of higher dimensional phase space. This is implied in quantum theory itself. Do you get a sense, Jim, of what I'm trying to get at here with?
Yeah.
Okay. So physics itself implies that at the quantum physics level, there is this, if everything emerged from a singlet state, everything is phase entangled, which implies that ultimately, to understand any particle, it kind of ends up implicating the whole universe. Now, this idea was developed most in modern physics by David Bohm and his writings in the book called Wholeness and the Implicate Order. And this is the same basic concept that Bohm arrived at. And just to quote David Bohm here, Bohm was a colleague of Einstein, and there were certain paradoxes in quantum theory and relativity. And he said the only way to ultimately resolve these paradoxes is if we accept the undivided wholeness of the whole of the universe. He wrote, ultimately, the entire universe with all its particles, including those constituting human beings, their laboratories, observing instruments, etc., has to be understood as a single undivided whole, in which analysis into separate and independent existent parts has no fundamental status. So what David Bohm is saying is similar to what Blavatsky is saying. Ultimately, there's this level of undivided wholeness. Now, the occultist, in a way, begins from this point. They begin from the idea of the undivided wholeness, and then they try to explain the derivations of particular entities beginning from the unity. Whereas scientists, in a way, they have examined all the particles and trying to relate the studies of the particles, they strive towards the unity, and scientists arrived at this idea of the fundamental unity of creation. But they kind of began from below. They began with the quanta, to understand the quanta and the paradoxes of understanding those quanta, and that led them more and more to Bohm's postulate of the undivided unity of creation. Okay. Any thoughts, Jim? I'll give one example. David Bohm, there's certain enigmas in quantum theory and relativity theory that he uses to explain some of these notions. One observation, he notes, for instance, if we take an atom, and if an atom absorbs a photon, an electron absorbs a photon, it jumps into a higher orbit. Because around the nucleus of the atom, there are seven main orbital structures. Okay, just like I imagine, encourage you to imagine you have a nucleus in your heart, and around that are seven layers or shells. Well, an atom's like that. It has a nucleus and there's seven shell structures around it. And the electrons in the shells, as they absorb a photon, they jump into a higher orbit. They give off that photon and they fall into a lower orbit. Now, the point is that these electrons move between orbits by taking a quantum jump, that they don't go from the second to the third orbit. They don't transverse the space in between. Instead, one moment they're in the second orbit, the next moment they're in the third, and then they're back in the second. It's as if a person, one moment was in Montreal, the next moment was in Los Angeles, the next moment was in Chicago, but the person was never in between. Okay, so this suggests that if a person could manifest like that, be in one city one moment and then another city the next moment, it would suggest that there has to be higher dimensional structures which make this all part of one system, all part of one quantum system. That was one of the enigmas that Bohm thought, was that the way in which the electrons moved within atoms suggested that there had to be underlying wholeness. And he applied that basic concept then to deeper studies of quantum theory. Any comments, Jim? I'm not sure that point's coming across. Or...
Well, yeah, I understand what you're suggesting. I mean, that his concern for recognizing what the nature of this holism is behind his work and led him to a very interesting theoretical explanation of it. But just thinking about, you know, Einstein's comment that he couldn't accept this holism, but in a way too, it's interesting when you consider that concept in terms of what mystics throughout the ages have experienced in terms of, not intellectually, but in terms of their experiences of higher states of consciousness, and they describe being one with the universe, and that description applies to a variety of experiences and a variety of different levels, I think, of higher states of consciousness. It's interesting that skeptics and scientists always kind of like dismiss that, like, oh yeah, one with the universe. But when you consider it in terms of, you consider it in terms of itself, if you take it at face value, it's a profound concept. But it's especially profound when you consider it in terms of this holism that physics is grappling with. And there are people throughout the ages who've apparently directly experienced this holism.
Yes, like Yogananda's experience.
Oh, I was thinking of Yogananda in particular. Yeah, where he describes, you know, having this experience of expanded universal consciousness, where he's standing and all of a sudden his consciousness starts to fill the space all around him, and then goes out into the heavens and goes into higher worlds, and he sees creation, the manifest world being created and resolving back into the higher dimensions. I mean, he actually experiences all this and sees it, you know, quote unquote. And when you consider that in terms of what we're talking about here, in terms of this holism, it's you know, again, it shows that these ancient mystical ideas anticipated all the major problems and breakthroughs in modern physics in one way or another.
Yeah, they suggest that reality has to have some fundamentally different nature than what we ordinarily imagine.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, like in Yogananda's experience, where his consciousness comes back to his body at the end, he says, I realized the point of intuitive perception within my heart was tied to the whole of the outer universe.
Yeah.
And it's like in the Upanishads where it says, the sun, the moon, the earth, all things in the outer world are within the lotus of the heart.
Yeah.
Now, what this suggests, like, we might imagine diving down into the lotus of the heart, into the zero point in the heart. And as you get down into deeper, deeper space, then your presence in that information field, in that field of omniscience. You see, this is how if we, our consciousness goes down to a lower level within the heart center, we have access to this field, more and more of this field of information that permeates all space.
A lower level of the heart center, or would you say a higher level in the heart center?
Well, I was thinking lower in terms of going down into deep space.
Yeah,
but, I mean, you could say higher.
Yeah,
I mean, it's more within, without.
It's more within. It's more an inner directedness than
higher or lower.
Yeah, you know,
but I'm thinking of lower in terms of the
deeper,
underlying realm.
More primary.
Yeah, but really it's more within.
Yeah, but I was going to just respond to something you just said about the experience of Yogananda and describing being one with his omniscience in his experience, he describes it in terms of the bliss of the experience, and all of these explanations always come couched in those terms that there's this incredibly magical, graceful, elegant, whatever it sense of the beauty of it all, and I was thinking in terms of the verb that Madame Blavatsky uses, which I love, when she says that it thrills throughout creation. The verb
throughout every infinitesimal point. Yeah,
yeah, it thrills
throughout.
I mean, what an amazing verb to use. I whenever I read that quote, that's what strikes me, is that it thrills. Just the idea that there's something that thrills throughout the universe is just so extraordinary and so inspiring, in a sense that, wow, you know, something's thrilling through every cubic centimeter of space.
Wow, it's so nice how you relate that. It's so nice how you related that to the description of the bliss of the heart. Because it's like that thrill, that inner thrill, is kind of experienced in the bliss of the heart.
Yeah.
In the sheaths of the heart center. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's what I think mystics, you know, repeatedly describe in the opening of the higher or deeper or whatever the heart space is, this experience of consciousness, is that the oneness has this thrill to it, this bliss, you know, that there's, it's not just something that you know, but you know it, and it's like you're a fire, you're on fire with the beauty and the wisdom of it all.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's nice. I like how the Hindus describe the Jiva Atma as Sat Chit Ananda, being consciousness
bliss. Yeah.
It's like it's thrilling, like it's, you know, it's,
yeah,
just that, it's like this, yeah, high modification of this thrill, that ceaseless eternal breath that is kind of thrilling through everything. Yeah.
I think most people, or many people, who have some experience of a higher state of consciousness, or a moment of awakening or self-realization, I think they have a sense of that in their own lives, that there's been this moment when you really knew something, and you knew it with your heart and your mind, and there was a quality to it that was distinguishable from anything else that we normally experience, and I think we get a taste of that from time to time, many of us.
Yeah, 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 and we want to cultivate that.
Yeah, that's what we want to aim to awaken in ourselves and to develop and to cultivate.
Yeah, yeah, excellent. Oh, thanks for connecting that all to the idea of the bliss sheath in the heart. That's really valuable to give a sense of the importance of this concept. I'd like to give one other illustration. You know, in my new version of Microcosm, Macrocosm, one of the most complex chapters is this chapter on information theory and black holes.
Right.
But maybe I can explain a basic idea from that chapter. And This is, I read an article from Scientific American on this, and in it, the scientist is talking about how when a material and energetic system collapses down to a singularity or zero point level, then according to modern science, you have the conservation of, you have the laws of entropy. Now, as the matter and energy collapses into a black hole, there's a loss of entropy because of the annihilation of the matter and energy. And according to the newest model in physics, this is compensated for by an increase in entropy of information, which what this implies is that as a material energetic system collapses to zero-point sources, what you have is the outpouring of all the information that was the counterpart of that matter energy. So that's why they actually talk about having a black hole computer, because it's like as you go down into a black hole, it predicts there's this vast sea of information. I don't know if that's coming across, Jim, what I'm saying. But it's interesting to see the created universe, the sun, is a four-dimensional space-time continuum. Okay, and it's made of matter and energy, in a sense. And as it collapses back to a zero-point source, what becomes available is all the information that was embodied in that whole system.
That's better.
Yeah.
I think that's a good explanation right there.
I think that, as mentioned last week, the best illustration of this concept is as how Tibetan Buddhists and the Dalai Lama say that as we approach death, all the vital energies and the energies of consciousness withdraw from the outer body, and they all ingather back to the heart. And as these energies are withdrawn into the heart, then what a person can see their life flash before them. And it's just as if everything that ever happened in their life still all exists, and the person can see their whole life. Yeah, it's like all that information of everything that ever happened to you is still all there, saved in the memory of your heart, at this deep level of your heart. So as your consciousness withdraws into the black hole, then all the information of your life can flash before your eyes, because it's in this field of omniscience. And as you withdraw into the higher dimensions of this, of yourself, then you can experience those levels of that omniscience. You might then remember everything in your life. So this is similar, I think, to how an energetic system might collapse to a black hole and you have the information output. So I think that's a possible kind of way of viewing what happens through the death process. Any comments, Jim?
No, I'm just at, well, actually,
you got the basic,
I understand. Yeah, I understand the idea. I think that's a very good analogy that and in the Tibetan system, everything withdraws from the material plane and goes into this point, like what you would call a zero point, and then passes into the subtle realm and you, quote unquote, pass into the subtle realm and go through the different stages of death after that. I think that's a perfectly logical, analogy with what you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I was thinking just a simple demonstration. It's like I'm looking at this information on my computer screen, and if I turn my computer off, all the light and all the information is going to disappear, but it's not really going to disappear. It's just not going to be visible in this plane anymore, and then it's going to go into my drive, and then when I turn it back on, it can reemerge and come back on,
it's the same idea, and the
idea all
the
information
is
still
that,
there. It's just not on the same plane.
Yeah. And that's the idea of the heart, is that some mechanism within the heart is this kind of perfect ether, and everything that happens is recorded there. It's like the ultimate ether. Everything that ever happens is remembered.
I think whether we began a talk, I think, on the last program I did about this, but I think what's very interesting is once you have this idea, the concept of the dynamics of the zero point, where something on one level or dimension passes into another dimension and is reconfigured in that other dimension, and you start to apply that scheme you start to look at almost anything, you can kind of understand how powerful the idea is of that this is applicable to, you know, both on the level of creation and the level of the individual human being.
Yeah, it's a very it's such a remarkable different kind of perspective. Even how it applies to a human being, like if take a human being and we consider a fertilized ovum, it's essentially a zero-point source. It's a point so small it's barely visible to the naked eye, almost visible, just at the edge of perception. So in a way, a human being, our material body, grows from a point source. And in a way, it grows from within without. It's not built up from without. It somehow unveils itself and unfolds from within without.
Yeah.
So the actual material body also grows from what we could call a singularity state as a fertilized ovum. We ourselves grow from such a singularity condition. So then as these cells multiply, they're all interconnected in higher dimensional phase space. Everything is connected to everything.
But beyond that, I'm
suggesting not only a human not only the universe emerges from a singularity and the human body grows from a zero point, but also human consciousness similarly has zero point origin, and that's different. That's
I was going to ask you. Why don't you briefly explain your perspective on what happens with the sinoatrial node and the heart and how consciousness emerges from the heart.
Okay.
Because I think
in,
it's...
As you say, it's an enigma how the heartbeat is generated within the SA node and the AN node and the bundle of His. How the heart, the generation of the heartbeats actually in three phases within the heart. And this can't be explained by external influences. It's somehow inherent to these cells within the heart. And scientists have been unable to explain this in terms of external material causes. Whereas in what I'm trying to argue, this really is a higher dimensional metaphysics which within the heart actually ties into the physics of the human body, bringing life into the heart and ensouling the human being. And so there's actual physics and metaphysics to this process. Okay, I think I'll try to get back a little bit and carry forward. I'm realizing we're moving along here and there's other major points I'd like to come to. Now, first... pick up on the stanzas again. The last stanza, we read some of stanzas from two. Stanza three says, "The last vibration of the seventh eternity thrills throughout infinitude. The mother swells, expanding from within without like the budding of a lotus. A vibration sweeps along, touching with its swift wing the whole universe. And the germ that dwelleth in darkness, the darkness that breathes over the slumbering waters of life. Darkness radiates light, and light drops one solitary ray into the mother deep." Again, we have the idea as in Kabbalah, that there's a ray of light which penetrates into the mother deep. The ray shoots through the virgin egg. The ray causes the eternal egg to thrill and drop the non-eternal germ, which condenses into the world egg. This is what Blavatsky states. Now, I'd just like to draw an analogy. I think what Blavatsky is describing here, the first point of differentiation is at the level of a singularity. But then what happens as that ray penetrates into the mother deep, it drops the world egg. And I would say this is similar to, in modern physics, it's called the inflationary era, where, as one author described it, the universe expands exponentially quickly from a singularity condition to something the size of a grapefruit. Okay, this is the first inflationary era in the universe. And I think this is very similar to what Blavatsky is describing here, the dropping of the world egg. Similarly, I would say human being, you have a jiva atma, zero-point source, but then that condenses into the bliss sheath, the size of a small grape, and that's your world egg within your heart. That's also called the causal body. It's described as the size of a small grape. It's a mass of unemergent light. So for you go from a singularity to this world egg, which is your bliss sheath within the heart. Okay, and then Blavatsky then carries on from there as in terms of explaining the differentiation of different forces. Now, one more thing I want to discuss is, here's another stanza. Reads, the primordial seven, the first seven breaths of the dragon of wisdom, produce in their turn from their holy circumgyrating breaths the fiery whirlwind. So Blavatsky's referring to the primordial seven. And she explains that the firstborn are what she calls the seven luminous suns. And she explains seven inside, seven outside. So when creation manifests out of non-being, these seven luminous suns, the seven spiritual intelligences, emerge out of the non-being. And that's the first realm of creation in spirit. And then she discusses the second realm of creation in matter. And she explains that in order for spiritual intelligences to act upon matter, there's a third character which she calls Fohat, spelled F-O-H-A-T. And she describes Fohat as the steed or the horse that carries the influences of the spiritual intelligences and brings those down into matter. So it's as if, like a Christian would say, a man has a body, soul, and spirit. Well, the soul is what connects spirit to the body. So Fohat is how a human being is ensouled in the physical body. And the Fohat is this ensoulment of the body that carries the influences of these spiritual intelligences. If you have access to the hourglass kind of illustration on my webpage, it shows like a realm above, which comes down to a point, and then it opens up below into a world below. Well, it's this character, Fohat, which carries the influences of these spiritual intelligences and impresses them upon matter. Okay, now, in modern science, it has traditionally been dualistic regarding the world as composed only of matter and energy. But what's happened in newer quantum theory is that information is now regarded as a third force. Physicist Wheeler says, it comes from bit, meaning a bit of information. It, meaning a material energetic system, comes from bit, comes from information. So it's like the energy matter comes from the information. So modern science for the past century has mainly dealt with matter and energy and haven't seen information as third force. But if we study the secret doctrine, we realize that everything that manifests within a space permeated by this omniscience, this spiritual and divine intelligence. So space is permeated by this intelligence. So this is the basic concept in how mystical teachings are so different from modern science, having this triunity of intelligence, energy, and matter. Okay, so Blavatsky says the firstborn are the seven luminous suns, so they exist on the spirit within the spiritual world. And then there are seven thohats carrying those influences, and then there are seven secondary realms of creation. So firstly, this before creation happens is seven inside, and then creation happens, the seven inside manifest to seven outside, and creation is first within the heaven worlds, and then subsequently the secondary creation is of the material planes. And again, the patterns of sevenfoldness are carried out, evident throughout. And Blavatsky, another stanza from the Zen, it reads, "The swift and radiant one produces seven Laya centers and seats the universe on these eternal foundations." Now, although sometimes I've talked just of one zero point, at times Blavatsky says there are seven zero points, seven Laya centers, and these can be one within the other. So it's similarly to how a human being, you have seven chakras in your subtle anatomy. Now, each of those chakras has a central point. Okay, so even in your system of chakras, you have seven Laya centers, seven zero points, and then at the deeper level, those seven separate Laya points all become one on a deeper level. So in explaining the laws of physics, I try to come to some of the most profound ideas in Blavatsky, her explanation of the laws of physics. Try to find this quotation from her. All here, from the Secret Doctrine, all the so-called forces of nature, electricity, magnetism, light, heat, etc., are in essence, in their ultimate constitution, the differentiated aspects of that universal motion, that's the ceaseless breath. For formative or creative purposes, the great law modifies its perpetual motion on seven invisible points within the area of the manifest universe. Okay, now, what she's saying, the great law modifies its perpetual motion. The perpetual motion is the ceaseless eternal breath. So you have the ceaseless eternal breath. But when manifestation happens, that ceaseless eternal breath, its perpetual motion is modified on seven invisible points. Okay, so now I want to try to come to what I relate this to in terms of modern physics. In modern times, scientists have tried to unify the four fundamental laws of physics into one superforce. And there have been different models to do this and ongoing attempts to unify the laws of physics. Now, one approach, so far, they've been able to unify electromagnetism and the weak force. And it's called the electro-weak unification. That's the first the first level of where the two laws were explained as variations on one principle. But to unify those two laws of physics, they have to postulate certain new classes of of quanta at more energetic vibrational levels, and that requires three higher dimensions. And then to unify strong force into the picture, they have to postulate other fields and quanta. And then to unify gravity into the equation, if they add it all up to provide a consistent explanation of the laws of physics, the most advanced theory is 11-dimensional KK supergravity theory. And this postulates that every point underlying the four large dimensions of space-time in which we live, at every point underlying the four large dimensions are seven hidden compacted dimensions. And this is a model that's emerged in physics. Now, if you're available to the website there, if you scroll down the page towards the bottom, you'll see at one point it's an illustration from Scientific American, 1985, and it was about the 11-dimensional supergravity theory. And what this picture portrays, it shows a field of flat, and at every point on this field, there's a sphere, a hypersphere. And in this article, what they explain is that the writers say seven hidden dimensions of the universe have been proposed in the theory that seeks to unify the forces of nature. The seven hidden dimensions can be pictured as a small compacted sphere structure, such as a sphere that is associated with every point in space and every moment in time. So, and this diagram, it shows one of these seven-dimensional hyperspheres at every point underlying the four-dimensional space-time. So in a way, what I'm trying to point out is this is the same basic concept as being presented by Blavatsky when she says the ceaseless breath modifies its motion on seven invisible points. These occurrences are all occurring down at zero-point levels. And if you look at these diagrams, you also see below it, if you go down a little bit further, you see on that page a Calabi-Yau space. In physics, in the newest theory called M theory, which is an extension of string theory, because they used to think strings were simply like strings, but rather than having membrane or surface structures. Well, in the newest physics, they think that at every point in space-time is a seven-dimensional Calabi-Yau space, as you see pictured on the web page there. And if you scroll down further, you see an illustration from The Elegant Universe by Brian Greene, which shows how at every point in the four-dimensional space-time, you have one of these little seven-dimensional Calabi-Yau spaces. Okay, so what I'm saying is essentially this concept that the laws of physics emerge from within without down on these compacted, at the level of these compacted dimensions. I think this is what Blavatsky was suggesting in The Secret Doctrine. And what I'm trying to explain in my writing and some of it today is how that applies to the newest concepts in physics about these seven-dimensional Calabi-Yau spaces. I'm also suggesting that human beings have such an element. Like Blavatsky would call it a monad. If you could imagine each human being has one of these little seven-dimensional Calabi-Yau spaces at the heart of being. It's a monadic essence. And this monadic essence, in a way, is established in higher-dimensional space. And it's through the mechanisms of this that the gods and other invisible powers clothe themselves in bodies. these bodies are spun around the central element, your monadic essence. Okay, according to Leon Maurer, a theosophist who studies and writes of these matters, he describes the monadic essence in hyperspace has certain spin properties as part of the ceaseless path. And this spin of the monadic essence, you might imagine it imparted, the spin properties being imparted to the surrounding medium, which forms, which crystallizes materials around the central point. So it's because of the spin properties of this monadic essence that it spins web around the monadic essence and then clothes it in these different seven different bodies. A little bit of a mouthful, all that. How's that, Jim? You're familiar with the material more. Do you think that conveys some sense of...
I know about it, but I don't think I know it.
No, nor do I.
It's just, it's interesting, though, because we keep adding these dimensions to account, you know, to provide the proper framework to in which they can unify the laws of physics, of the fundamental, the laws of the fundamental forces. It's, but again, it's fascinating that it leads to numbers that are startlingly familiar to mystics and, to those who know the ancient teachings.
Yeah, I think that's profoundly important. And there are different models in physics today. Some postulate seven dimensions, some have ten, some have, larger numbers. But, I mean, definitely, if you were testing the hypotheses proposed by the secret doctrine, hyperspace is seven-dimensional, and there are seven invisible points.
Yeah.
And in physics, if you look, this model of these little Calabi-Yau spaces down at these Planckian levels, that's exactly what's being depicted by Blavatsky, how these spiritual intelligences act from within without, from be at a level where we can't even differentiate their influences, that they're an underlying process that then produces outwardly the world of our perception and experience. And then to imagine that a human being might similarly have such a monadic essence or seven-dimensional Calabi-Yau space within the heart. All of this kind of provides an alternative model for trying to understand the forces of nature.
I'm looking at the Calabi-Yau image, and I'm wondering, is it a stretch to liken it to a lotus, or if has it kind of like, dynamic, like it's something that's unfolding? Do you see that at all?
I don't think it unfolds because I think it exists in hyperspace. Its effects unfold in the external around it. But I think that element just retains within itself. I think things unfold around it. Yeah, I have the site there, Jim. Also, go down the bottom of the page and see that kind of geometric symbol there, the Star of David in it.
I was looking at it, yeah.
Yeah, it's so hard to explain what this picture is, but...
Where does it come from?
It comes from a book on Kabbalah and modern science.
Oh.
And the author is explaining that there are four worlds. Like, if you have the ladder of Jacob image and you have four worlds...
Right.
Of emanation, creation, formation, and the world made. And if we had these four... trees of life strung together in the image of the ladder of Jacob. Now, if you were looking from the bottom of the ladder of Jacob up towards the top, then all the points on the central pillar would overlap each other. And this image is really a depiction of looking up the tree of life, what it would really look like. And what I'm in that picture, I'm trying to show how similar that is to the Calabi-Yau space. I mean, they almost look identical, except one's geometric and one's more organic looking. that is actually, that illustration is actually got the 11th invisible sephira in the world of creation. And the forces around it depict the matrix of creation established around the central point. Okay, and that's a basic idea that is also in Blavatsky, that we have a central point, and in mysticism sometimes say the center which is everywhere and the center which is nowhere. Mm. And it's like every place is the center, because everything accesses that field of omniscience, so any point is the center in the sense. Okay, well, to come back, the study of Blavatsky is extremely difficult, and I've just tried to introduce some of the basic concepts. There, another scientist, Jack D., of the Department of Chemistry at Arizona State University, he had these comments on the secret doctrine. This is from a book on Symposium on the Secret Doctrine back in the 1980s. He wrote, a scientist of the 1980s can adopt one of two attitudes towards the contents given out by H.P. Blavatsky's secret doctrine. The first attitude consists of disbelief. It assumes that the secret doctrine is a product of an overactive imagination and that no more time should be wasted in checking its claims. That second attitude consists of openness and a willingness to examine the claims of the secret doctrine in light of the best available knowledge. I studied the secret doctrine with both an open and yet critical mind. The writer must admit surprise at the similarities of descriptions given by modern science and the secret doctrine of space, time, matter, forces, and fields. Before the advent of quantum mechanics and field theory, the ideas of space as presented in the secret doctrine would have been considered nonsense. The ultimate aim of physics, it is said, is to unify the forces of nature into one grand equation is the dream of the physicist. The aim of the secret doctrine is also to unify, to show that the legends and traditions around the globe have common origins, and to show that all existence on this objective plane is derivative of a metaphysical plane. In this search for unification, both modern science and the secret doctrine meet at a common point, the vacuum state of physics, the Leia point of the secret doctrine. So what D is saying is that it's this concept, the enigmas of the quantum vacuum and the zero point. Those concepts are, that is where Blavatsky's secret doctrine most provides this alternative interpretation on modern ideas in science. He refers to what's called the Leia point of the secret doctrine. Blavatsky sometimes calls zero points Leia centers. She says, like, try to explain this. At one point, Blavatsky in the secret doctrine says, are atoms eternal? And she says, atoms are eternal, but not the atoms that physicists are working with. She says, the atoms are eternal, are elements in their Leia centers. In their Leia centers, they're undifferentiated. So what the atoms that are eternal appear as nothing. They're unmanifest because they're withdrawn into a Leia center. So that, I'm not sure that this is coming, it's awkward to explain this, but the idea of the Leia center is where everything kind of disappears and is unmanifest into a zero point. That's where the true essence of something is, in its Leia state. And when creation occurs, that is creation out of a Leia center, differentiation from a Leia center. So Dean in this quotation is saying this: in the search for unification, both modern science and the secret doctrine meet at this common point, the vacuum state of the physicist and the Leia point of the secret doctrine. Okay, it's like both the scientist and the mystic trace the origin of cosmoses back into the nothingness. It's like as we trace something far back far enough, it disappears from view on the lower plane. One final quotation here from this scientist, Dee, explaining what an unusual idea of space-time is inherent in the secret doctrine. Dee explains, space-time is created by being squeezed out of a point. A space-time structure is squeezed out of a single point. With this interpretation of space-time, certain paradoxes of non-locality, which require superluminal speeds, are no longer paradoxes. The reason is that everything is always connected because everything is really part of the same point. We might imagine what the long body of the universe. By long body, it's like taking the universe as it exists over time and imagining it at one point everything is absorbed in non-being. And then the creation emerges from a point source that expands within without, and eventually it dissolves without within back to the zero point center. Now, in a way, space-time is squeezed out of this point. So everything within this space-time is interconnected within the quantum realm. Okay. It's very hard to convey the essence of the secret doctrine and some of what's being suggested here. For Blavatsky, space-time as we think of this exists, does not exist. Space is an illusion. In a way, everything is everywhere simultaneously. But we have our own zero-point center. It's like there's a higher dimensional physics involving this monad, and that higher dimensional physics projects and creates this illusory realm around us, which is impermanent. But that center is within us. Here, Blavatsky writes, the secret doctrine postulating that conditioned or limited space and location have no real being except in this world of illusion, or in other words, in our perceptive faculties. It teaches that every one of the higher as of the lower worlds is interblended with our own objective world, that millions of things and beings are, in point of localization, around us and in us, and we are around with and in them. It is not metaphysical figure of speech, but a sober fact of nature, however incomprehensible to our senses. So Blavatsky's saying here, there's millions of worlds right within our own space, within ourselves. We're just not perceptive of them. And that all of what seems to be external space-time, it's all in a way an illusion, something created by this higher dimensional metaphysics to physics process. I hope I see we're coming down. We have a few more minutes, and I'll turn to Jim. Any comments on?
Well, just at the end when you're talking about the illusion, and I mean, it recalls the idea of Maya is that Maya is the principle. It's often described as illusion, but the illusion arises when you take something out of its full context, and that's the illusion, is that you don't understand that the manifestations in this realm are rooted into these higher dimensions in which all the apparent differentiations and separateness becomes resolved because everything is rooted into these higher dimensions. And I mean, that's a recurrent theme throughout mystical and esoteric teachings throughout the ages, is that in a higher state of consciousness, part of seeing the oneness of everything is to see through the illusion of this world.
Yeah, yeah. And an interesting quote from Blavatsky on the nature of space. And
yeah.
It's like how, it reminds me of how in new photographic techniques where they use holographies and you can record memory by shifting the light slightly, you can record all these different memories on the same volume of space or
yeah.
something. And it's like space is full. It's like there's all these worlds within us. If we went down into ourselves at a lower depth, we might enter those worlds and become aware of those other spaces around ourselves or of other beings. In a way, we have access to this vast sea of information at these lower levels.
Yeah,
ourselves.
It was like, I remember the first reading in Search of the Miraculous when Gurdjieff says, when he's talking about how worlds interpenetrate one another, and they're visible to us. And he says, you know, there's in order to study the stars and the planets and other worlds, there's no need to go there. All the matter of the sun and the moon and the planets are within everything around us, and that they all interpenetrate. All these different worlds interpenetrate, and all these different worlds are within every volume of space around us, you know. And I remember reading that and thinking, what an extraordinary idea. And I mean, obviously I didn't know whether it was true or not, but just thinking, boy, you know, like, how could that be? And here it is again, you know, and I mean, now we know how it could be in a sense. We have a much better
understanding. Have a much deeper sense of
exactly.
The science of how such things could be true.
Yeah. And I mean, in future programs, you get into an explanation of the holographic model of things. You can amplify on that and explain how that really vindicates or really provides a model which is completely compatible with Blavatsky's position and with her descriptions. I mean, just the brief quotes that you read are just extraordinary from her about her descriptions of things. They're amazing.
Yeah, really quite profound. It's remarkable that it was over a century ago and she was trying to describe things. In those days, you had no language for it. It was so far away from what science was suggesting. Mm-hmm. And it's curious how Blavatsky even said that she expected her teachings to be rejected in her century, but in the century to come, they would realize that the secret doctrine has neither been invented nor exaggerated.
Yeah, and
she really provided a model of higher dimensional physics lying behind the physics of life manifest in the world around us.
Yeah, and as the chemist that you quoted said, you know, you can take one of two perspectives on this. You can just dismiss it, or you can try to understand it. You know, and when you try to understand it, if you have an open mind and you really examine what she's saying, I think it becomes very obvious that these are very profound ideas.
Yes. Yeah. And then, as we see these same teachings and ideas in other teachings, which even just further explicates. So I'm running out of power here. I think we're kind of closing down. Well, that was a bit of a rough slog today. The Secret Doctrine is certainly not an easy read, and I thank the listeners for listening in and
okay, we're going to have to wrap things up. We got another show coming up, so thanks, and we'll see you soon.
Yeah, thanks, Don. Thanks, BBS Radio. Thanks, Jim Moffat. We'll see you in 2 weeks' time.
Thanks, Chris.
Goodbye.
Bye.